From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. More than 93,000 women veterans live in Georgia. Once returned from active service, many face issues assimilating: childcare access, employment, health care, even homelessness. The VA has slowly introduced more services for women veterans, like the Women Veterans Office here in Georgia, but there is more to be done. With me now is Bridgette McCoy. She's vice chair of the City of Atlanta's Veterans Affairs Commission and CEO of Women Veterans Social Justice Network. Welcome, Bridgette.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And also here is Vita Brooks. She's director of the Women Veterans Office with the Georgia Department of Veterans Services. Hello, Vita.
Hello.
Thanks so much for coming in, both of you. Both Army veterans, correct?
Yes, correct.
Now, Vita, I'm going to start with you. Women veterans are not always the first thought when we think groups of veterans or veterans services. Why do you think that is?
A large part of that is because women don't always identify as a veteran.
Well, why not?
Because when it's been ingrained in us that when you think of a veteran, you think of someone who is big and male and is fighting on the front line. And socially, we believe that the women are behind the men and the men are in front protecting them. That is the image, I believe, that America is comfortable with. So to change that culture and let them know that women are fighting next to men, that we are not that far from them on the battlefield, it's a slow process. But we are veterans and we're out there and we have the same leadership skills and abilities that our male counterparts have. But I don't think it's viewed that way.
Yeah, maybe our image has not kept up with what's actually going on in the culture.
Absolutely.
Wouldn't be the first time that that has happened. But you run the Women Veterans Office here in Georgia. This was founded just 2 years ago, 2017. Why is it important to have an office specifically for women veterans?
Well, first, I just want to give credit to Commissioner Roby because he realized that we have a subpopulation, which are women veterans. And those specific needs of women veterans needed to be addressed. So when he developed the office and our team, he just really understood what type of support we were going to need. And so it's important because when you go out and a female veteran applies for a job, it's important that they understand that those leadership skills are important on their resume. It's difficult for any veteran. You're a tank driver. It's hard to transfer that to a civilian job. There's not a whole lot of tank driving going on. So we have to help them understand what that means in the civilian world.
Bridgette, I'm wondering, women veterans, fastest growing demographic using VA services, but the VA hasn't always been welcoming to women. So what was it like for you? What were your interactions with the VA when you got out of the service?
Oh, they were very limited. I think probably the year that I got out was maybe a year before the law. They had changed the law to actually have women, gendered services, which was like in the early 90s, like 90, 91. And so most people don't realize that someone had to go to Congress to fight to change some of the policies within the VA so that would be made available. But when I got out, I didn't even know that had happened. So I did not use the VA. It was some, 15, 20 years later that I used the VA. And it was only after I was insurance poor. Basically, I was working a job, paying insurance, and could not afford the co-pays and the medical to be able to go to the doctor. So I started utilizing the VA. So it wasn't that it was welcoming. There was nothing ever that was a draw for me. So that's, pretty much was my experience coming out of the military in the 1990s.
Vita, does that sound common to you that women don't use it until, pretty much their back's up against the wall or they have to?
Yes, that is true. And it's because the environment was not inviting when they went 15, 20 years ago. And so once you mark the box that the place you've gone into is not user-friendly, you just decide it's not worth going back. But then when your back is against the wall, at least you have some health care.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Bridgette, this is something that particular to your experience, but has been a unfortunately, we've heard a lot about the experience of sexual assault inside of the military service. And you've spoken out a lot about how the military has handled that as a survivor yourself. How were you treated when you came forward about that?
So I first want to say there within the military, there are great people serving. There is much more people just doing their job and not assaulting people. And the challenge is we want to remove the people who are assaulting the serial rapists and the serial assaulters. And so for me, coming out of the military and going into the VA, being 20 years later, it was only at a screening that they were starting to do back in 2007 or 8, where they were asking directly, did you feel safe? Those kinds of things. And, you know, it was odd to me, but I felt like maybe it was important to say yes, because that was my experience. And then that started me on a path to getting the appropriate mental health care. But in that process, I became homeless again and was going through a divorce and had a severe relapse in some of my other medical conditions. And so that accelerated the rate of me getting care. But if I would have just been someone who just, you know, has a job and just going back and forth to work, I don't know that I would have gotten as much care as quickly are as intensely as I did because of my situation with being homeless and having other medical conditions exacerbating the post-traumatic stress.
However, as even if it is more rare than not, you have helped women file claims about military sexual trauma. So what has it been like to get these claims filed? As you said, 2006, 2007, it feels like there was a lot more awareness about the problem then.
So by 2008, once I realized that the situation was as grave as it was, I was online. I had met all of these wonderful women who had served like during Vietnam and all of those eras pre my service, and they had experienced sexual trauma. And so I thought, well, maybe I can use technology to connect with other women who've experienced this. And I started a page on Facebook, and that's really how WVSJ started. And from that page, I didn't necessarily help people in that, like, I did their claims for them. I just basically gave them information and resources and plugged them in with other people who knew how to process claims to help them in that process. And so in about 2008 through 2010, we were just still getting our claims denied left and right. I mean, it was just ridiculous. And about 2011, after going to D.C. and really pushing to change some of the policy, we had a breakthrough, and they decided to make some changes. And from that those changes, the claims began to be appropriately adjudicated based on markers in the experiences that people had had. They might not have had a police report, but they had markers in their military file that showed they went from being a really great top shelf soldier or airman, and then something happened. Nobody knew what it was, and then all of a sudden they were missing work and having problems. And so we were able to help so many women and men, for that matter,
be able men to. Men are also victims of this, or survivors of this, should say.
Yes.
Vita, you're nodding, so this is something that comes up a lot in your work?
Yes, it is. Our department, we file those claims.
Yes.
And it does come up. And they are looking for markers now. One of the things that is important for us at GDVS is that we also recognize that sometimes when someone is sexually assaulted, the only way to get their power back is to overachieve. And so we cannot discount the person who reports, but then they have this stellar record because that's the way they win. And so it is... It is very important that we just recognize that this is not just recognize it's a problem, but appropriately respond to the call for help. There is nothing worse than walking into a VA hospital or clinic and saying, I am a survivor of MST and I need some help. And then someone asks you for a piece of paper, a DD-214, right, or a diagnosis or anything. I don't need to go to eligibility. I need someone to talk to me so that I don't become one of the other statistics, which is the unfortunate increase rate that we have in suicides. And so it is definitely an entire environment change that we need.
Yeah, I'm looking at data that says from the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs reporting that there were more than 6,000 veteran suicides each year between 2008 and 2016, an absolutely staggeringly unsettling and really unhappy statistic. That just most recently spoke is Vida Brooks. She is director of the Women's Veterans Office. And also with us, Bridgette McCoy. She is vice chair of the City of Atlanta's Veterans Office. Vida works for the state office. Well, obviously, this is, you know, MST, as you called it, military sexual trauma, a big issue facing women returning home from the service. But you also mentioned finding a job is difficult. Isn't this one of the things that we think of as an on-ramp to a great career, being in the military? You're either going to go to school, you're going to find something. Why has it been so difficult, do you think, for women veterans in particular?
It's been really difficult because what we're finding is that those women are coming out much younger. You do a few tours in Afghanistan or Iraq, and then you're ready to come home. We're also seeing, unfortunately, an increase in divorce rates while on active duty, mm-hmm. which means that produces a lot of single parents coming out. And so if you are a single parent and you're looking for work and you have no income coming in, there is a unique survival box that you check. You must survive. You have to take care of your children. So you put off taking care of your mental health. You put off taking care of your physical health. And so when you combine all of those things, whether you are male or female, it is a problem. Translating what you did in the service, I was a combat medic. When you come back to the civilian world, I have to translate that. And so that someone who's reading my resume understands. When I talk about a soldier or a veteran talks about being a squad leader, corporate in general doesn't understand mm-hmm. what that entails. So it is the truth is when you leave the military, you don't even speak the same language as your civilian counterparts. Uh-huh. There are things we say and there are things that are done in the service that if I were just talking to you military, you'd be very unsure if I can actually communicate with the general population. And how would that translate to that veteran being the face of my company? So there are a lot of things that need to be addressed in the out processing, in the transitioning.
Right. But I can also see those things, those qualities making great leaders and great workers. You know, somebody who has discipline, somebody who's used to showing up, someone's used to proving themselves. Yes, Bridgette.
Can I say something to that?
Yeah.
I think the other challenge is when you serve in the military, everything that you need to know about the person that you're looking at is physically on them. Their rank tells you where they sit. They have patches on that tell you what unit they're from, and pretty much you can ascertain, you know, if they're working in an office that's where they work. So all of those things are like cues to you. And so when you leave the military, everything is decentralized. You no longer have everything that you need at your fingertips on the base. Now you have to figure out where everything is. So that adds a complexity to it. And then now you're going into the workforce. Most veteran military personnel don't necessarily know how to network. So then there's an added, you know, challenge. And then with the way that things are now, things like LinkedIn and social media add another complexity. And so if you already don't know how to translate your skills, you're not networking, then it's going to put you at a slight disadvantage. You can have a better advantage if you know how to use those things. But who's going to tell you how to do it?
Right.
Because the people who think they know how to do those things don't always know how to translate it to how to do it for somebody who's coming from the military. So it's there are things that are challenging, but there's hope within this process, because I believe that women veteran are the greatest untapped resource that our nation has. I feel like with the right tools, the right resources, and the right funding for programs and services to professionally develop women veteran, you will definitely have the type of people that you need to make get your company to have the great revenue that it needs and to have a beautiful brand. I mean, we automatically have the leadership. We can, you know, handle things in difficult situations. So help us to take that and you know, create these opportunities within the community to you know, put women veteran forward. I think that some of the challenges are focused on. Suicide is a big issue. It's a public health issue. But if you have the money to take care of your family, if you can pay your light bill, if you're not trying to boil water to, you know, heat, you know, water in your home, I mean, things that really create, you know, stress to somebody who already has a medical and mental health issue. If we can remove a lot of those barriers, a lot of the challenges, like in my case, a lot of those challenges will be ameliorated. And so that's most of the work that I do, trying to make sure that women veterans are put forward. I mean, that's a big, you know, hairy goal. But I think as Americans, we're ready for, you know, we're ready to do this. This is something that if everybody knows that that's what we need to do, then we will dig in and get it done.
Well, I'm wondering for you, Vida, thank you so much for summarizing that so beautifully, Bridget. But for you, Vida, you are working statewide. Access is a difficult thing for a lot of people, especially in rural counties in Georgia. How do they get to these kind of services that Bridget was describing?
Absolutely. And that's where networking comes in and partnering with veteran organizations so that the VA may not, it is not, first of all, you have to understand that the VA has they have a mission, and none of that mission includes transportation. It was not built in. So we really are looking at how do we reach out to service organizations to help transport people from the rural areas over to where they can get some help. The other thing is also, how do we market a way for civilian practitioners to be trained to understand the military culture so that they can then turn around and we don't have to pick you up and drive you 2 hours because there's someone in your community who already understands. It's an education part. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. We've opened up a lot of big topics here and hopefully seeded some good discussion. But I really want to thank you, Vida Brooks, Director of the Women's Veterans Office with the Georgia Department of Veterans Services, and Bridget McCoy. She's Vice Chair of the City of Atlanta's Veterans Affairs Commission, CEO of the Women Veterans Social Justice Network. Thank you both.
Thank you
for having me.
That's it for our show today. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. You can email us at onsecondthought@gpb.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Be back again tomorrow with On Second Thought.